Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. My panel today, Hildegard Nocton, Minister of State at the Department of Climate Action and Transport, Breed Smith, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South Central, and Kathleen Function, Sinn Féin TD for Carlow Kilkenny and Chair of the Oireachtas Committee on Children, Disability, Equality and Integration. Now let us know what you think. You can text us on 51551, email saturday at rte.ie or tweet to at Saturday RTE. But first today, I want to go to the CEO of the HSE, Paul Reid, who is joining us from our Athlone studio. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Paul, the Taoiseach said yesterday that our hospitals are experiencing their most terrible week of the pandemic so far. 50 deaths reported last night, 1,850 COVID patients in hospital today, 191 of those in ICU. To what extent are we now using surge capacity across the system?
Yeah, Katie, you just quoted the figures there, which are absolutely correct as of this morning. So we are right now, what our intensive care consultants would say to me is the whole system is completely tightening up. We have formally gone into surge capacity. The way that would work is individually some of the hospitals would have already gone into surge during this week. But we've now stood up our National Critical Care Surge Group, which literally gives oversight across the whole hospital system, across all hospital groups, mobilising the likes of our mobile intensive care ambulance service, where we need to transfer patients in between hospitals for intensive care. So it's extremely tightened up is the way I would describe it. If in terms of beds, we now have manned beds in terms of staffing and available beds. We've surged that up now to about 313. You'll be familiar, it was about 285 in total before. We've surged up. So we're at 313. We have 28 beds available for adults and 12 paediatrics at the moment. So it's getting extremely tight.
And have we had to transfer people to hospitals, in ICUs and other hospitals yet?
No, we haven't actually mobilised that, what I would describe as mobile intensive care ambulance service to do that. But certainly what is happening at the moment is individual hospitals would be scaling up to surge capacity beyond their normal capacity. But where they can't go beyond that, that's where we would activate that process of mobilising between hospitals. But right now, our primary focus has been on creating capacity across all general beds. We have about 480 general beds available across the system. But if I could just briefly, Katie, I mean, I know the focus is understandably on ICU, but, you know, of those 1,848 of the 191 in ICU, there still are about 250 people, not in ICU, but who would be receiving a kind of intensive supports, particularly in terms of oxygen, sometimes high flow oxygen supports. And indeed, last night I was talking to Dr. Ross Morgan over in Beaumont. And, you know, that's a very significant number of people we will be treating who need respiratory supports, advanced respiratory supports in what we would call the, I guess, the orange zone or the amber zone. So, you know, significant supports before ICU.
And do we have any concerns about, for instance, our capacity in that line? Like, do we have enough oxygen? Because we saw in the UK that there were questions about hospitals running out of oxygen in these circumstances.
Yeah, and talking to even Colman Loughlin, one of our intensive consultants in the matter, the way our consultants would describe this phase now is different. It's more about the people and the treatment of the virus and the disease, because we are stronger now in terms of the, I guess, the infrastructure in terms of PPE, ventilators, oxygen, is stronger, much stronger than we were in the first phase in terms of preparation. But it is now about a critical issue in terms of how we manage the people, our patients. People are quite sick with this virus, and we are seeing families being treated. We're seeing young people being treated in hospital. So again, it's a really strong message out to the public. This virus affects everybody.
Yeah. And in terms of staffing, Paul, we know 800 staff from the hospitals in Cork and Limerick are off duty this week because of COVID. I know Colette Cowan from the University of Limerick Hospitals Group saying that they are in an emergency situation in terms of staffing. What is your plan? What is the HSE's plan to cope with this?
Yeah, well, if I can give you kind of national perspective on it in total across both our acute hospital system and indeed our community and community services, disabilities, mental health, nursing homes, we'd have close to 6,500 staff out now right now, but over 4,000 of those would be in hospitals with significant pressure. We would expect to see a reasonable number of those staff. We're just monitoring, obviously, in terms of they would be positive cases of COVID and close contacts. We would be monitoring, and we would expect to see reasonable numbers of those staff coming back very shortly. However, as part of that, we have also redeployed, as part of our mobilisation plan around ICU surge, redeployed some teams to support ICU. I do want to assure our listeners, we are coping, but under significant stress. So if you do need care, if you do need urgent care, we're there for you. But what we've had to do in terms of staffing is, you'd be familiar with this, we've had to suspend non-urgent care in our hospital services. And, you know, thankfully, we have brought on some extra beds prior to the, as part of our winter plan. And we are also using and triggered the private hospital agreement. Right now, we would have about 125 beds supported in private hospitals to support us as well.
This is for non-COVID?
For non-COVID cases. Urgent care, yeah, it would be cardio care, cancer care. And just thankfully, we don't have the traditional trolley crisis that we would have. For our flow through of hospitals is stronger. We've about 78 trolleys versus this day last year we would have over 300.
Although I understand there is significant number of people on trolleys in Limerick.
Yeah, across Limerick and Cork would be our hottest sites. Has improved this morning,
Have we got to the stage yet, say, and particularly in Limerick and Cork, who are under such pressure, where patients are being treated in car parks and ambulances?
No, we haven't, Katie, and it's exactly what we want to avoid. When we're looking at the model numbers of what we may see in our hospitals in terms of COVID presentations, but also in terms of ICU. And we have been looking over the last while at the hospitalizations getting to probably about 2,500. We're not there. And our ICU for COVID patients of, you know, maybe one rising to about 250. Thankfully, we're not there yet. And we everything we can do in our power is not to get there, and indeed everything the public do to help us not get there is really important. I just want to keep stressing that if I can.
Okay, can I bring you on to the vaccination programme in nursing homes? We know from your own numbers that the HSE has put out that of the 77,300 vaccinations that have been given to date, just 7,900 of them were to people in nursing homes. Can I just ask about that? Because I thought nursing home residents and staff were going to be the top priority. Did that change in those early weeks?
I'll just say in the introduction, I know we spoke about hospitals there, but we are also under significant pressure in our nursing homes all across the country. About 25% of them would have outbreaks. So very significant numbers. So our vaccination programme is key for us. I guess the first 10 days of the vaccination programme, we took the guidance from the National Immunisation Advisory Committee, which was to start it safely, effectively, securely, and a balance between frontline healthcare staff and starting the programme in nursing homes. So we have started to the ratio that you've just described, about 8,000 vaccinated. However, our programme now for nursing homes is accelerated between this week, the end of this week, and throughout next week. We'll have completed all nursing homes, having been completed our first vaccination, and indeed by the middle of February,
they'll
have had their second vaccine. So it is a priority.
So is that timetable still in place? I'm thinking about the implications of yesterday's announcement by Pfizer that there were going to be a curtailed supply of their vaccine over the coming weeks.
Yeah, to be frank, the Pfizer announcement yesterday afternoon, we weren't happy whatsoever when we start hearing the first announcement from Pfizer. And I know it got escalated to senior government levels, and I know the Taoiseach made calls across Europe on it. Thankfully, the situation as announced last night from Pfizer is that it won't have the impact that was originally projected. We are looking at 1 week, which is next week, of a shorter supply, but then getting back to committed supplies, and indeed the middle of February getting to extra supplies. So I think the interventions at European level helped. But
getting their vaccine next week then, if we're looking at that fall off in supplies? Will frontline workers, healthcare workers, have to wait now if you're prioritising the nursing homes?
Yeah, well, just to assure your people in nursing homes, residents and families, that programme continues as planned. The plan for this week and next week continues as we would have planned. So our plan primarily for next week was nursing homes, and that was the primary focus. And it was the following week we will be reverting back to primary healthcare workers in acute and community settings. So the plan continues as projected next week, and we'll obviously have to recalibrate the following week based on a 1 week less supply.
But who loses out in that scenario?
Well, in essence, the following we will have done the private nursing home, so that will be completed. There will be no impact. It will just mean a lesser volume as we move back to healthcare workers for that week. But it is a much smaller impact than we would have projected, and we're in a better place than we thought we were yesterday afternoon.
Okay, well, that's good news. At least we'll hang on to every bit of good news we can get. There's three mass vaccination centres operating, as I understand it, today in City West, in Dublin, in Galway, and in Portlaoise. How far advanced are we in terms of securing the other 12 centres that are proposed?
Yeah, very pleased to say the three mass vaccination centres which we've set up today, which is primarily utilising the Moderna vaccine, the 3,600 vaccines we got. So over this weekend, targeting between the mass vaccination centres and indeed some nursing homes, some GPs and practice nurses from their practices will be vaccinated. I'm pleased to say it's going extremely well in those three sites you mentioned, St Mary's, Merlin Park and the Collational Hotel in Portlaoise. And they are 10-bay sites. And just to come back to your question about how many in the future, but what we are piloting this weekend is they are 10-bay sites in each one of those, vaccinating about between 40 and 60 persons per hour, supported by National Ambulance Services, Defence Forces and the DGPs. So the wider programme of mobilising for that is currently being finalised between our own estates, property people, looking at mass vaccination centres across the country and the workforce to do that. We will also be...
But can I just ask you the question, Paul, was when? Mm. When are we going to see those up and running?
Well, it's largely a function of the supply, Katie. So once we... If we look forward into quarter one, our primary supply across, and hopefully the AstraZeneca approval at EMA, our primary cohorts are, in the first instance, complete the programme for nursing homes, staff and residents. Also then the primary cohort of workforce is about 150,000 healthcare workers. And then the third important cohort is the 500,000 who will be older persons, not in living in long-term care facilities. And that's the primary focus. And that's why we are vaccinating, working with GPs and pharmacies in the coming days and weeks to prepare for that.
Okay.
That's the next element.
Okay. And can I ask you then about the Beacon? A lot of controversy blown up over the last 24 hours in particular about the use of the Beacon as a vaccination centre. I know the Taoiseach is saying yesterday that you should review this, you know, because the Beacon didn't pull on the green jersey and sign up to the deal to provide beds in this emergency.
Yeah, can I just, in answering your question, just take the two pieces separately, because in terms of the vaccination centre and then signing up to the private agreement, because the two issues have come together this week, and I can understand people's concern on this one. But on the first one, which is the signing up to the private hospital agreement, which we were referring to as safety net, we've had very constructive discussions with all private hospitals over the past 2 weeks. Very pleased to say 17 of the 18 private hospitals have now signed up to that safety net agreement, which gives us capacity of up to 30%, but can go beyond that as required. However, I do have to genuinely express my extreme frustration that the Beacon hasn't signed up to that agreement. I mean, we have our public health system facing the biggest crisis probably in the history of the state for our health services. We have a team of fantastic team of people all across our hospitals, including private, working relentlessly. But we are racing to save people's lives here. And, you know, it is beyond frustration for me. It's beyond belief and comprehension. And I would be urging their board to sign up to the safety net agreement. Now, separately, if I can, Katie, just address the vaccination centre.
Yeah, go on.
So the issue of the vaccination centre, we're working on in parallel with our Ireland East Hospital Group. That it was provided purely at no cost to the HSE by the Beacon, and we're grateful for it. It provided it just last week. 1,000 of our staff were vaccinated there, again, by volunteer vaccinators from the Beacon.
But it doesn't look good, though, does it, that staff in the Beacon, which, as we say, has not been contributing to this COVID cause at the moment, are getting vaccinated ahead of, say, those healthcare workers from Nina Hospital who, you know, went so far as to put out a video online yesterday saying they're frightened, they're seeing colleagues get sick, and they don't have a date yet for their vaccination.
Yeah, and again, if I can take the two pieces separately, in terms of the Beacon staff being vaccinated, the Beacon and indeed other private hospitals, there's no distinction of the vaccination of primary healthcare workers in our sequencing. So it is for private and public. Secondly, the private hospitals do carry out very important work for us, including the Beacon, which would be urgent, critical care, cancer, oncology, cardio. So protecting healthcare workers in private and public is important for us. Now, they are very small and marginal numbers in the Beacon who have been vaccinated, and that's similar in the Hermitage as well, which has been referenced. But in terms of Nina and other hospitals, we do want rapidly to get out. There is a distribution gone this morning.
Can you give them any date? Oh, it's gone to Nina. Will that cover the staff that are there? Or
No, it won't. It's the start of a distribution. But again, in all of our hospitals, we have not had the supply to cover. And look, can I just say, I appreciate everybody's frustration and the demand for vaccine. If we had 500,000 this weekend, I know we could distribute them and vaccinate them, but we have to prioritise the supply that we have at the moment.
Okay, can I just say, I have a statement in from the Beacon Hospital. It refers there, as you said yourself, that that vaccination centre was offered to HSE healthcare workers and free of charge, at no cost to the state, no contract is in place, all work has been carried out as a goodwill gesture. But in relation to the point you were making, you had some very strong words to say about them there and their refusal to sign up to this deal. They say that while engagement is ongoing with the HSC regarding a new centralised arrangement, the Beacon Hospital is of the view that it can treat more public and private patients through its existing arrangements rather than through an additional new agreement. So there's that there. I just want to move on from that, Paul, because I wanted to ask you about the IT system. Mm-hmm. I think people are really shocked that there are people with pens and papers handling the admin of this in nursing homes and in other settings. Why don't we have a fully functioning IT system for this? Why wasn't it procured back in the summer when we had time and space to do this?
Yeah, well, just a couple of things. We have procured a new national immunisation system, which is a partnership with IBM and Salesforce.
When was that?
It was procured in December. Quite accelerated procurement.
Why was that only done in December?
Yeah, and I understand, and the people would say, why didn't you do it in July, as you just asked, and that's a fair question. The reality of it is, Katie, the specification of the system, the requirements of the system, the knowledge about what kind of vaccines we might be getting, how you would register people, what the sequence of who gets registered. Most of that information became available extremely late in December. So, you know, you do need a base level of information to develop the system. So there are three elements of the system, just to reassure your listeners. There is the about how we record the data of the people being getting the vaccine. There is the actual data on the vaccine itself that we have to record. And there is a portal, which is the third element that comes into play.
Where you book your vaccination.
Well, equally where the GPs will be able to start to register people. And then, you know, it is just in terms of paper or pens and paper, you know, nursing homes where we are doing this in long-term care facilities, they wouldn't be naturally integrated with the HSE system. So we are uploading data through spreadsheets into the central system. That's where we are at the moment. That will improve as we move into the wider mass vaccination and we have our portal available.
Okay, I'm going to actually leave that there, Paul Reid, because I'm watching the clock and we want to get our panel in on this. But I want to thank you for joining us today from Athlone. Paul Reid there, the CEO of the HSE. Go back to that vaccination priority group issue. Maybe if I bring you in, Minister Hildegard Lockton, are you surprised to hear that only 10% of those who have been vaccinated to date are those most vulnerable in nursing homes?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge what Paul has said there in relation to the work that has taken place in relation to the vaccination rollout. And I think to acknowledge as well in that Ireland is currently one of the first or second in Europe in relation to that rollout. And as Paula said, this will depend on the supply. And we have been assured, government has been assured, that the resources will be there for the rollout. The only anything that will hinder the rollout of this vaccination will be the supply. And I think he has clearly outlined the enormous work that is taking place in relation to the rollout of those mass vaccination centres across the country, and the work that's been finalised with the other 12 centres as well. So this is about targeting the most vulnerable, the nursing homes, the frontline workers. And I think we could hear the assurance there and the intention to roll this out as quickly and as effectively and safely as possible.
We got an email into the programme this morning saying... from a nursing home manager describing themselves as very frustrated, saying that they don't begrudge the healthcare workers access to the vaccine, but our nursing home residents being forgotten again, a second scandal. Our health services regard for older people in nursing homes is a disgrace. Breed Smith.
Well, I think there's a real problem here, because I know Paul Reid answers the questions and very carefully answers them, but he doesn't really answer them either. So, for example, on the question of the immunisation database, which is holding up the speed at which the vaccine can be distributed.
They would say, just to be clear, Paul Reid would say it isn't, that is, the supply is the only thing that's actually holding
up. I'll come back to the supply in a minute, but we have heard witnesses saying it takes a long time to record the data while you give it to one patient before you move on to the next. This was flagged up to the department by the public health doctors, who have threatened, or not threatened, but have taken a ballot for strike action over their particular situation. But this was one of the issues that they flagged up very clearly. We have never had a national immunisation database, and they should have known, as you quite rightly asked them, why wasn't this prepared for last summer? And I don't think the answer you got was sufficient. And in relation to the nursing homes, yes, they were forgotten about and treated very badly the last time. Their staff struggled to get a hold of PPE. People were making PPE and sending them in. We remember those horror stories, and the rate of death was actually horrendous. So there should be a priority put on them. Having said that, we do have to vaccinate all our frontline workers, because they're the ones who are playing a superhuman effort, if you ask me, in trying to keep the rest of us safe. And they need that reassurance as well. Can I just say a word about the supply issue before we move off it? I think that there is a debate happening globally now about the question of patent. And we need to argue at the WHO, at the levels of the UN, etc., that these vaccines should be made patent free. This is a global pandemic, and public health should come first. And any country who can get a hold of a patent free vaccine type should be allowed to reproduce it themselves. And we are very well placed to do this. We've one of the biggest pharmaceutical industries in Europe, and we could be producing, in particular, the AstraZeneca vaccine. If we win this argument, it happened before with South Africa arguing for patent-free reproduction of generic drugs in relation to HIV/AIDS. We need to do this urgently on a global scale, and Ireland should be to the front of arguing for it.
Okay, Kathleen, can I ask you, were you reassured by what Paul Reid was telling us there in terms of the plans for the rollout from now on?
Unfortunately, no, I wasn't. And I have to say, I think we were in this situation since last March. We've nearly had a year to plan in relation to vaccines, but also in relation to staffing, hospital capacity, bed capacity, ICU capacity. So, I mean, we've had years of underinvestment in our health service, and it wasn't in a good state before COVID. COVID has made it extremely worse. That's even an understatement. But what really is frustrating for people is the fact that we had time to plan to a certain extent for staffing issues, for capacity issues, for ICU capacity issues. That clearly wasn't done. And talking now about implementing, you know, the plan around the vaccine, that should have been done as well. We all knew that the whole world was working towards a vaccine. We were hopeful that there was going to be a vaccine. So why were we not putting those plans in place, including whatever IT systems need to be put in place? It's a bit late in the day to be saying it now, but I think it's really important to make the point as well that, you know, in relation to that Ireland's call, remember last April that was brought out. There's about 1,400 staff that were never contacted. Doctors, nurses, healthcare assistants. Why aren't they being drafted in? Why aren't they being hired to help with the staffing issue? We have an example in our own hospital in that services Carlow and Kilkenny. It's a 15-bed ICU, state-of-the-art, brilliant facility. They only have the staff to manage 6 beds. So why can't they look at that list of 1,400 people that applied, that are obviously trained in health services.
Yeah, mind you, I doubt it very many would be trained to the level, as we know, no, very highly skilled.
Maybe not, but there is people there that are nurses, that are doctors, that are healthcare assistants, and all of those jobs are required. Staff are absolutely exhausted. They're gone past the point of breaking point. And it's very frustrating that measures aren't being taken in relation to that and in relation to bed capacity. We published a plan, our health spokesperson, last August about, you know, fast build modular facilities to deal with ICU capacity, and none of this was done. And we really need to look at that. And the last point I just want to make, Katie, is in relation to the private hospitals. Paul Reid said they are 30% roughly capacity. We need to be using that at 100%. We're gone beyond crisis mode. We're constantly here and everyone has to do their part. And for the public, it's very frustrating when you are doing your part,
you're staying home, you're doing all of that, to you, Hildegard Nocton.
And you see they're only taking up 30%
of that
capacity.
Do we need to go back to that deal already and say 30% is not going to cut it?
I will answer that. And can I just say, in relation to the preparation, there's been significant increase in bed capacity put in over the last few months in relation to dealing with this. In relation to ICU capacity, you're correct, Katie, that ICU nurses and the staff, it's a very specialised skill set. And there has been huge preparation, extra PPE, oxygen, all of the resources put in place. The fact is that we have, three variants now, an increase in the numbers, and it is up to all of us to do what we can collectively. So I just want to knock that in the head because Kathleen has said that nothing has been done, which is absolutely false. In relation to the
enough has not been done. If you were listening to Paul Reid, you'd know that yourself.
Kathleen.
And I don't want to politicise this because we're in a crisis here, and it's important to acknowledge the work that has happened. And I think it's important to stress that and not to politicise it. In relation to the private hospitals, just very briefly, Katie, in relation to your question, and Paul outlined it there as well, that if more than 30% capacity is required, that will be sought. And the message that we need to get out here, and not to scaremonger, we all know what we have to do to reduce this virus right across the country. Our health workers are working furiously fast. We're also doing relatively well in relation to this vaccination rollout, and it's important to acknowledge that. And as Paul Reid has said, supply will be the issue, not the putting in place of resources. We have huge expertise within our public health system. Doctors, nurses who are well qualified and well experienced in administering vaccines.
I'm sorry to cut across you, Minister, but I do have to take this break.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, before we move on from this, I just want to play a short clip of the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, who was on the News at One yesterday. He was asked if a further, if in future the government would be in lockstep with NPHET in deciding what restrictions should be in place. Here's how he responded.
You know, we'll always listen to and consider the advice, but ultimately, government has to make a decision. And, you know, the advice last time, let's not forget, was to move from level 5 to level 3. I'm not sure we would take that advice if that were advice was given again, because that turned out to be too quick.
That was Leo Varadkar talking to Brian Dobson yesterday. Hildegard Nocton, why is Leo Varadkar suggesting that we are where we are currently because the government followed poor advice from NPHET?
I don't think that's what he said, in fairness. I think it's very easy to look back in hindsight if we knew where we were going to be right now in relation to the decisions that we made.
He said, just be clear, because there's a lot of misinformation floating around on this issue this week. He said there that the NPHET advised to move to level 3 and that we wouldn't follow that advice again because that turned out to be too quick. But of course, we all know that that's not what NPHET advised. NPHET advised to move to level 3, but to keep hospitality closed. And if you were to open hospitality, you couldn't allow household visits. And we allowed, the government decided to allow both. So is that not a serious misrepresentation of the advice that was offered to the government in December?
No, that's not the full picture. And again, I don't like going back in time, but if you do need the clarification on it, I can give it. So what actually happened back in December was that NPHET advised that household visits would be permitted from December the 2nd, and the government decided that we would hold back on opening up household visits until the 18th of December and instead open up hospitality. But look...
NPHET specifically advised against that, against opening up hospitality. hospitality.
Yes, and I don't want, look, but they were saying that household visits could happen from the 2nd of December.
If so hospitality stayed closed.
Yes, so we made the decision to not allow household visits until the 18th of December. But really,
the point I want to ask you, Minister, with respect to every single decision, Katie,
back over time, and none of the modelling was pointing to the scenario we are currently in. None of the NPHET modelling, and that is not a criticism of NPHET. It's not a criticism of
but
anybody.
What Leo Varadkar said yesterday certainly sounded like a criticism of NPHET.
What is very clear to us all, and the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, and many of my colleagues have said, that this virus is constantly changing, constantly evolving, constantly ripping up all of our plans. The NPHET modelling didn't predict the current situation we're in, and that is not a criticism of NPHET. This is the nature of the virus. This is
you're
the
not
global
going to address
the
what
virus.
The Taoiseach said yesterday, Hildegard.
I have addressed it. I have addressed it, Katie. And what we need to do now is to all knuckle down and do what we all have to do to reduce this virus and to ensure that we get it under control, and that we do. We are always taking, government always takes the best advice, makes decisions on the best advice that we have at the time. Again, if we could make a decision and look back through today's lens,
I hate to constantly cut across you, particularly when you're not in the studio with me, Minister. But it's just we have a lot to get through, and a lot of time is moving on very quickly. Bree, please.
Well, I mean, when Leo Varadkar says the last advice from NPHET was to go to level 3 and all the rest of it. Actually, I've written down the dates here. The last advice from NPHET, the last two pieces of advice, on the 24th of December, they called for immediate implementation of level 5. On the 23rd of December, they re-emphasised that we need a full suite on level 5. When did the government introduce it? The 31st of December. Now, what Hildegard or Leo Varadkar won't acknowledge is that what we're seeing now in terms of the crisis we're in is the bitter fruits of their decision to ignore NPHET advice that originally said, as Katie pointed out, don't do both. Don't open up hospitality and allow people into each other's homes. But you chose to do both. Okay. And some of us in the Dáil saw it coming and warned you that we'd be at this place. And you haven't even nationalised the hospitals, as the Irish Nurses and Midwives Union have called for. You need to nationalise the private hospitals to get on
top
of this.
I'll cut across you now, Breed, because I do want to get on to an issue that's hugely important to many, many families out there. Last night, a letter was sent to schools outlining procedures for reopening schools for children with special educational needs, saying everything was agreed. The understanding was that everything was agreed between the department, the INTO and the FORSA trade unions. FORSA later then came out to say, hang on a minute, we still have concerns. Can I get clarity from you on this, Minister? Has agreement with the unions been reached or not? Where are we at this?
So the position is that FORSA and all the other key stakeholders were working and have worked on the guidelines that were even announced last night in relation to the back to work protocols. So these discussions are ongoing, with the determination and the objective of having special needs classes reopened on Thursday next. So that work is ongoing. And
but there was no indication in that letter last night that this was an ongoing work in progress. Parents took it that they were back in school next Thursday.
Well, that is what I suppose the teachers, the unions, the school management have all been discussing, with the objective of reopening special classes from Thursday in a staggered format, as outlined in that guidance released last night. And it's important to say that FORSA were part of that, and I would thank them for their engagement. And I know that they are continuing to engage with the Minister and the Department of Education in order to progress this and iron out any of the difficulties, as they have been doing over the last few days. So this work is ongoing, to answer your question, and I would hope by early next week all of these issues would be ironed out.
Kathleen.
Yeah, there's very clearly an issue here, because on the one hand we had an announcement made yesterday that seemed like the special schools and special classes would reopen from Thursday, and then very late last night that seemed to be contradicted by the unions saying that full agreement hasn't been made. And the the people suffering in all of this, of course, are the children with additional needs who were totally abandoned and forgotten about in the last lockdown by the government. And now it would look like the same is going to happen again. And I think actually it was on this show at the news when it was described as cruel. That's exactly what I would describe it as. You know, parents and children with additional needs anyway, far before COVID, always had to battle for absolutely everything, for assessments, for therapies, for classes, for transport. And now they were let down very badly the last time. There was lots of discussions. There was a COVID committee set up. There's two ministers in relation to this because there's a minister for education and special education. And yet here we are with an announcement then being contradicted. And it's really unfair to families, to parents, to those children. And I would say that the government really needs, and the ministers in charge of this really need to ensure that they have all their ducks in a row before they make announcements like that, that give false hope to families already in very difficult situations. And they need to ensure that everybody involved, whether it's your bus escort, whether you're a special needs assistant, are given the adequate supports and confidence to return to work, and that you know, provisions are put in place maybe for somebody that is high risk.
But can I just finally, before I leave this, Minister Nocton, we can't as of now, can we, guarantee to these families that they will have children back in school on Thursday?
What I can say is that every effort is underway in relation to opening up and ensuring that pupils with special needs can get access education, can get those supports. And I would completely agree with Kathleen in relation to the impact that this has had during the first lockdown for a lot of children, their skills. There was a lot of regression. And this is all about the children and the students, getting them that in-school one-to-one access. And I can assure parents who are listening here today that that is still the prime focus, and the department are working with the unions, teachers, management on that.
Okay. Now, can I raise an issue that is specific to your area of expertise and your area of responsibility, Minister? Because the Daily Mail reporting today that up to a dozen lorry loads of food have had to be destroyed due to post-Brexit customs delays at Dublin Port. What is actually causing these delays, and what are you planning to do about it?
Yes, so this is in relation to the movement of goods post-Brexit. And just to say, as we all know, a huge amount of work has taken place over the last few years in relation to getting the message and information out to companies in relation to what they would have to do post-Brexit. That was deal or no deal, that there were always going to be checks and SPS checks, deal or no deal. And this is the situation we're in at the moment. So just to say that 70% of the traffic going through Dublin Port is being green routed, which means it's flowing out of the port. There's no problem. Yeah, all of those companies have their documentation all in order. The issue is where companies and traders are not up to speed in relation to customs. So that's the owner of the goods. And just to stress that this is hindering the hauliers and people who are driving the trucks. It's not the hauliers' issues. It's the companies who own the goods. And what I'm calling on them is to directly engage with Revenue here, with the Department of Agriculture. If your goods are agricultural products, the helpline in Revenue, and this is one of my concerns, has been very low in relation to the number of companies contacting them. So if you want to move your goods at our ports, what you need to be doing is engaging in advance, in good time, with Revenue, with Customs, with the Department of Agriculture or the HSE, before your goods leave your manufacturing plants, so that they can have free flow through our ports when they come here. This is mainly a lack of preparedness by a number of companies. I have to say, many of them are up to speed and do have all their you know, they're proficient in relation to their custom systems. But the help of all of the information is there if they contact Revenue well in advance and the Department of Agriculture or HSE.
The president of the Road Haulage Association, Eugene Drennan, has called on the government to allow free flow of goods through Dublin Port for the next 2 weeks to deal with this, just because while people get their ducks in a row, basically. Would you consider suspending checks for a period until people's IT systems are up and running?
Again, this is a matter for customs, and customs and revenue have already put in an easement in relation to their online code system. But it's important to state here that the UK have left the customs union and the single market, and we have obligations, legal obligations, which we have been stating for years now. And these checks, agricultural checks, they have to take place. The best way to resolve this backlog and to ease the pressure on hauliers who, you know, are waiting too long now at ports because the advance preparation was not done by some companies, is that they get up to speed, they contact Revenue, they contact the Department of Agriculture and get their papers in order in advance of them leaving their bases to board ships, because they will have to be checked at our ports here in Ireland in order to comply with our EU regulations.
Okay, we're going to have to leave that there. We will take a break, but we'll come back after these to discuss that Mother and Babies Homes report.
Tweet at SaturdayRTE.
Now, President Michael D. Higgins said this week that the state must bear primary responsibility for what happened in mother and baby homes. And many people are still working their way through that 3,000-page report from the Mother and Baby Homes Commission that landed this week. We asked the Commission for a spokesperson or a statement yesterday, and they told us that the Commission does not intend to comment on its report. But we are joined now by Dr. Conor O'Mahony, Special Rapporteur on Child Protection and Director of the Child Law Clinic at UCC. Thanks for joining us, Conor.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Conor, the key issue for a lot of people in this has been the access to birth information. We know now from yesterday that the Attorney General has said that a referendum is not required for survivors of mother and baby homes to get access to their birth certs. Would you agree with that?
I would, Katie. I mean, that's a position that I've taken on this issue for some time now. And back in 2015, at the time, I was asked to appear before the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Health and Children, which was looking at draft legislation at that time. And I expressed that view then, as did others. And, you know, quite a number of people have agreed on that. Now, it was very welcome yesterday that the current Attorney General expressed the view that we don't need a referendum. I suppose what we're waiting to see is how, you know, conditional or unconditional that position is, because his two predecessors had both indicated that the Oireachtas could enact a law on adoption tracing on condition that certain things were contained in the bill, which would act as preconditions to access to information. And those preconditions, a lot of us would have, in the field would have argued, were not necessary, and they were objected to by
What kind of preconditions were they talking about?
So the original one in 2015 was that an undertaking would have to be given not to attempt to contact a birth parent who didn't want to be contacted. That was advised by Maura Whelan that would be necessary, and survivors objected to that. They said, look, this is our information. We shouldn't have to sign a legal undertaking in order to get that. The last Attorney General, Seamus Wolfe, had suggested that birth parents should have an opportunity to raise an objection in court if they didn't want a birth cert to be provided. And that, again, it didn't seem to be really properly supported by the law that was there. And, you know, was again another hurdle being placed in the way of adopted people seeking to access their records. So, you know, so yesterday's news was positive, but, you know, we will wait and see whether, you know, as I say, it's unconditional.
And in terms of the right of birth mothers to their privacy, to not be contacted, how would you propose to balance that?
Well, you see, we have to distinguish between access to records on the one hand, access to a person's birth certificate or their adoption file, as compared with access to contact information. I mean, those are different things. So just because you get access to a birth certificate, which tells you where you were born and what your mother's name was and so on, that, of course, particularly in the context of mother and baby homes, is not going to tell you where that person is now living. So the way that you can balance the two is that you provide, on the one hand, you vindicate the right to identity by saying that there is an automatic entitlement to a birth certificate and an adoption file. But on the other hand, contact information would not be provided unless the birth parent would consent to the provision of that contact information. And in that way, you can provide a balance between the two. What they also do in some other jurisdictions is require a counselling session, which would brief the adopted person on on the wishes of the birth parent and explain the potential consequences of not respecting those wishes.
So legislation, we're told, is on the way. Do we need legislation? Because there's some discussion that, you know, the GDPR legislation that's in place would do.
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways you can go about it. And one way would be to try and deal with it exclusively under GDPR. Another way would be to enact specific legislation. So there are different ways to achieve this end. You probably need to have some level of legislation simply because there's also issues around how the records will be retained and where they will be held. And some of those issues would need to be dealt with as well. So there probably will need to be some level of legislation. But exactly how that legislation approaches the issue, whether it does it as a standalone piece or whether it does it very much through the medium of GDPR, there are different options on the table, and I know the Department of Children are working very hard to explore those options and to establish what the best way forward is.
Okay, I just want to bring in my panel. Minister, can I put to you that when Roderick O'Gorman said this week that we would get to legislative scrutiny stage with this legislation before the end of the year, a lot of people were quite dismayed at that time frame. Do we really need that length of time to draft this, you know, discrete piece of legislation?
I know that this legislation, it is a top priority for Minister O'Gorman, and I know that intensive work is already underway in relation to that. So I know there's a real urgency around it, but at the same time, there's a real need to get this right to ensure that we take all the concerns of those involved, and that whatever legislation is put in place, that it is robust, it's workable, and we're not coming back here, you know, in a few months' time with half-baked legislation. So it is a top priority for him, and I know that he's working closely with the AG on this.
Can I ask then about the redress, the matter of redress? Your committee could have a function, a role in this, couldn't it, Kathleen?
Yeah. Can I just say firstly that we definitely need to see access to birth certificates and to both state records and any sort of files that are held on people who were adopted, whether that was through the homes, and there was a huge amount of forced adoptions that took place well outside of the home. So all adopted people need to have access to their birth certs, to their files, to their records. And I would agree with the point that Connor was making, that it's very different giving someone access to their birth cert and their information than actually saying, here's a telephone number for somebody.
And the reality is, though, in Ireland, you can track down people.
Well, no, look, the reality is there's a huge amount of people out there that haven't been able to track anybody down and that are still looking for either children or mothers, and it's totally unacceptable what happened in those homes and what happened to anybody that was in either the mother and baby homes, or actually mother and baby institutions they really should be called, or detention centres, and people who were put into those forced adoption situations. It was a human rights abuse. And there's no point in apologising this week unless we're actually going to get it right now and ensure that people have access to their information and their records. And yes, the Children's Committee, obviously, anything that we decide as the committee. I do chair it, but it's a committee decision, and it's an excellent committee.
But what about the fact that one of the criticisms of, say, the Clan Project would have had of the commission was that it didn't allow any public hearings. Some residents did want to tell their story,
of course,
in public,
yeah.
And Clan wanted to make a submission in public, and that didn't happen. So could this happen now at your committee?
First of all, I totally agree with the point they were making. I do think it's important for people to have the access to tell their stories publicly. I certainly would be open to that. As I say, I would never make a decision on behalf of the committee. We'd have to discuss it. But I think everybody on that committee wants to see the right thing done. And, you know,
would there be legal implications there, though?
I think that the same committee rules would apply. And I just make this final point that there was a number of really good recommendations made from the Collaborative Forum back in 2018 in relation to identity and information. They've never been acted upon. So in relation to something taking an awful lot of time, there's a huge amount of work done already. There's people that have been dealing with this since as far back as 2001, speaking to various ministers about it. So there is a lot of work done. It doesn't necessarily take a huge amount of time to get it right.
Okay, Breed, I know you're dying to get in. I just want to ask Connor, because he has the legal expertise there. Would that be an option, Connor, in terms of allowing a forum like an Oireachtas committee to bring in survivors and former residents of these homes to tell their stories?
I think it would. And I think what I would particularly like to see an Oireachtas committee involved with would be the process of formulating whatever redress scheme is devised. The state's track record on designing redress schemes for historical injustice is appalling and has repeatedly designed schemes which have made matters worse rather than better, have excluded people unfairly, have re-traumatised people. And it's incredibly important that we don't repeat those errors. And it's incredibly important that there's trust in what is devised. You know, the timeline that's been given of doing this by the end of April is welcome to have a firm timeline. You know, if you compare that, for example, to the redress scheme for sexual abuse in schools after the Louise O'Keefe case, it has been rumbling on for 7 years and 18 months after that was found to fail to comply with that judgment, we have no timeline on when they're going to reopen that scheme. So, you know, it's good to have a firm timeline, but it would also be important to have some transparency around how that process develops and how those decisions are made, and to allow survivors to have an input into that so that it isn't seen as another one of these exercises which is
imposed,
conducted really out of sight and designed to contain cost above all else.
Okay, Breach.
Well, this report is a disgrace, the way it was managed in its publication, in how the survivors were treated, the webinar that was held, the leak that went to the press in advance. But also, when we talk about identities and the right to identity in your history, they have that right, and absolutely there's no point in dragging out the length of time for legislation to give them that. But now this report has stolen their narrative. It repeatedly says that there's no evidence of abuse, that there's no evidence of forced adoption, and it dismisses the witnesses who painfully went through the process of giving their story to the commission, and it just takes the story and throws it out. Talk about an insult on top of injury. It should be rejected in its entirety, and the institutions who are burying evidence, who have refused to hand over papers and records and archives, must be compelled to do so. Okay. We could be witnessing crime scenes here with over 9,000 dead babies.
Okay, and just to repeat, as I said at the start of this, we did ask the Commission if they would give us a statement or a spokesperson, but they said they would not be commenting on their own report. So that's it. We're out of time, but I do have to bring you a further statement from the Beacon Hospital in response to those very strong words from the CEO of the HSE, Paul Reid, earlier. They say that the Beacon Hospital is currently treating more public patients than HSE agreement envisages or asks for, more than any other private hospital, saying public patients currently occupy over 50% of our intensive care unit. Approximately 20% of all surgery over the past 4 months has been on public patients through service level agreements with individual hospitals. It says the reason we do not wish to sign the current agreement with the HSE is that giving clinical control to the HSE during surge one agreement, the hospital was actually left 70% empty. As we are at full capacity currently, we cannot allow this to happen again. So that's the response from Michael Cullen, the CEO of the Beacon Hospital, to Paul Reid there. And there we leave it. The programme today was produced by Mary O'Hagan. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and Ruth Kennington was on sound. I want to thank my panel for joining us today and wish you all a very good weekend.
Saturday with Katie Hannan. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.